Hi, I'm Pete Hill, and this is the D Word podcast, where we talk dementia. Welcome along to another edition of the podcast. This week, my guest is Bill Wilson, who came to prominence earlier in the year when he featured in the BBC documentary Dementia: Fighting for My Wife, which told the story of Bill's struggle to support his wife, Jo, who'd been diagnosed with dementia in 2020. Sadly, Jo passed away in January of this year, and since then, Bill has been tirelessly campaigning to improve things for people with a diagnosis. So let's go back to the beginning of the story. When did Bill notice things weren't quite right with Jo?
It was about 2018, I think, when I first noticed there was something wrong with Jo. Didn't really recognise it. Didn't know if I was ignoring it or frightened of it or whatever the case may be, but I think it's safe to say that I was scared, because to me, dementia meant stress and strain and worry and all of those negative things that spring to people's minds. And when we eventually, after 2 years, managed to get a diagnosis, which is another bugbear of mine, why on earth does it take that long to get a diagnosis? It was a relief in one respect, in that I knew what I was dealing with. But all those negative terms were still at the forefront, because it had changed now from not knowing to knowing. So, and it still in my mind meant a lot of negativity. I was banging on doors and windows trying to get that diagnosis for so long. And the day before lockdown in 2020, the memory clinic rang me and said, if you can get Joe here within 20 minutes, we'll do the tests. Otherwise, we're closing now. So I just said, I'll be there in 10, and managed to get the test done. Obviously, we had to wait until June to get that diagnosis from a doctor who delivered it to me over the phone because of COVID. I knew what he was going to say before he said it. Obviously, I didn't know the type of dementia, and Joe had frontotemporal lobe with Alzheimer's. But he's after he delivered the news, he just said, do you have any questions for me? And I was like, well, I don't know what I don't know. I have no idea about this. So just tell me what's the prognosis? What does it mean for us? What are the stages of dementia? I just had a million things going through my head, none of it really making any coherent sense to anybody, not let alone the doctor. But to be fair to him, he did talk me through a little bit of what he knew, and in answer to my barrage of questions. And then it was a case of, well, that's it. Off you go. It's like, okay, so what do I do now? So I kind of took lockdown as an opportunity to do my own research, become my own expert. We got invited to the memory clinic when they reopened, and it was so frustrating and so annoying. Platitudes followed inane questions and discussion, which there wasn't very much of, I hasten to add. Jo and I were told what medication she would have without any explanation of what it was for and how long we would take it and what were the side effects that would happen. I felt as if I was being taken through a tick science and wasn't allowed to have a say in any of it, which, the doctor obviously didn't know that I could talk for Britain, and I was quite prepared to lay things on the line. But she really didn't want to know. And it was kind of, well, I've told you all you need to know now, off you go. So, I mean, we left, and the first thing I said to Joe when we got outside was, we are never seeing that doctor again. So I expressed my displeasure, got to see a consultant who was very good, explained all about different types of dementia and what the medications were for and why it was certain types and not other types. And so because I'd been able to do some research myself, I felt a bit more confident with it, realised that it doesn't all have to be bad. There can be good times as well. But my God, you're searching every day for those good times and hanging on to them by your fingertips, no fingernails sometimes. I would be looking for the wife that I had lost. And so I would just, like I say, grab onto any bit of happiness that I could find. I mean, the worst times are horrendous, worse than your worst possible nightmare. And you never know from 1 hour to the next how things are going to pan out. Jo and I had a wonderful life. She was a high-flying international executive, doctor of philosophy, very well respected internationally. And yet there she was, wandering around our home, talking to her mother who died many years ago. And I was also wandering around our home with keys around my neck, frightened that she was going to escape out of the front door or get into the cabinets that had all the cleaning solutions and things in them. So neither of us had a life of any kind any longer. But it was my job to, and my privilege actually, to help Jo on that journey. I needed to make sure she had the best life that she could have. And I wasn't bothered about the cost to me and all of that. And it wasn't until I collapsed at Christmas once. And I mean, we used to have fabulous holidays abroad. We were very, very lucky. We'd be in sun-drenched beaches in the Caribbean or the Far East or luxury cruises, whatever. Jo worked really hard to be able to have us do that. And I appreciated that. But then when I knew we couldn't have those holidays anymore, I guess I started grieving for the life that I'd lost as well as the wife that I had lost. And I wanted our first Christmas at home for many, many years. I had my rose-tinted glasses on, let's say that. And I thought it was going to be a lovely family Christmas, just the two of us. Santa would come, you know, and of course I had wrapped all the presents and put them around the tree, the ones that I had bought for Jo and obviously the ones that I'd had to buy for myself, because Jo by this time had no capacity about what Christmas was all about. But still I was in denial, and still I thought, no, we're going to have a lovely time, but we didn't. If I'm honest, it was a very lonely time for me. Yes, I had people around me, friends and neighbours, not many family, I hasten to add, because they'd all kind of disappeared. But it was still lonely. I still felt isolated. And I just collapsed on the kitchen floor one day and I sobbed inconsolably for 45 minutes.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
You're in tune with the D Word podcast and my guest Bill Wilson, who's telling the story of his life with wife Jo after a diagnosis with dementia in 2020 and the increasing struggle to care for her while receiving very little support.
It was like there was no end to it. I felt no one cared, no one understood what I was going through. Fortunately, Jo was in a different room, didn't see any of it, so it wasn't upsetting to her. And I know there are crisis teams, and I know everybody gets a phone number to ring in the case of a crisis. But, you know, when your whole world is disintegrating around you and it feels like there's nothing, then crisis team doesn't exist in my head. You know, it was as if I knew it was there, but I couldn't ring that number because it wasn't registering in my head. So nothing was registering in my head. And when you're in a state of deep despair like that, nothing does register. And so a crisis line is like, well, so what, really? Because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't register. There is nothing. Mm-hmm. And I realised then that I had to do something more. And, you know, Jo and I had talked initially about how we could raise dementia awareness. Although, having said that, she refused to accept the diagnosis. She would always say she didn't have dementia. But she was prepared, and that's the kind of, it's a bit of a dichotomy, I guess. She was prepared to help me the way she saw it in getting the message out. And that's when the BBC and the Alzheimer's Society became involved. We launched Dementia Action Week on the BBC's Red Sofa. That was a phenomenal success. The calls were up 75%. And I was told, and I didn't understand a word of this, but I was told that we were trending top five on Twitter. And it went straight over my head because I didn't know what Twitter was all about. And I certainly didn't know what trending on Twitter meant. But it was good to know that the message was getting out there. And then when the BBC followed our story, that was great in itself, because not only was I getting the message across in the Northeast where I live, but also nationally and internationally. I was getting messages and letters from right across the globe. I mean, everywhere, Australia, the Philippines, Taiwan, Canada, right across Europe. And thankfully to the Royal Mail, I guess, a lot of them were just addressed to Bill and Jo Wilson, Newcastle upon Tyne, or Bill and Jo Wilson, BBC interview, Newcastle upon Tyne. And they were coming to me. I mean, bags and bags of letters. So I knew then that I had to start doing more, because the letters I was getting were just fabulous, really. I mean, there were people who were in similar boat to me and others who weren't, but had a better understanding now of what dementia was all about. And Jo used to attend daycare with Dementia Matters a couple of days a week. And I got in touch with their chief executive, Bev Reed. And so we teamed up, really, and we've established there an ethos of family-centred care to fundraise and raise awareness about dementia. And we're trying now to support the family members as well as those service users right through until bereavement. So that's something that I've managed to get my teeth into since Jo's untimely death earlier this year. And I've also started doing volunteering work as a volunteer research partner with Newcastle University on a range of dementia projects. I'm working with Newcastle Hospitals, NHS Trust, and this is a mouthful, Cumbria, Northumberland and Tyne and Wear NHS Trust, which is the local mental health trust. And so I've been able to use my experience to have a practical and strategic input to several different areas across service development in the NHS. And as well as that, I'm campaigning now through my local MP, and I've just been asked to talk to a cross-parliamentary committee on health and social care, because I have had a lot to talk about with social care in particular.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
You're in tune with the D Word podcast and my guest, dementia campaigner Bill Wilson, who, like all of us, is frustrated by the lack of progress at government level.
It's what, a year ago that Boris Johnson promised he would have this new tax and he would raise all these billions of pounds and it would be used specifically for social care. It was probably a bit duplicitous in what he had to say in that people immediately thought it would have covered all of their costs up to £86,000 a year. But when you read the fine print, it's like an insurance policy, isn't it? There's always that fine print at the bottom of the exclusions on it. And those exclusions were quite severe, but it was better than nothing. But of course, now our current Prime Minister has decided that that tax isn't going to happen. You know, the stuff that was going to come out in October, that's all been delayed as well. And it just seems to me that it's just a continuation of stuff. Government always seem to think that it's too big and too costly. And yes, it is very big and it is very costly. But it's like if you leave a leaking roof, it just gets bigger and more expensive the longer you leave it without doing anything to highlight it. So, and we've been hearing now, as you say, for a number of years about what needs to be done and how it needs to be done. And I don't know whether it's because government are elected on a four-year cycle and so they don't feel compelled to be able to do anything about it because they may or may not be in government in another 4 years' time. So I'm frustrated that government policies haven't led to more improvements. And like I say, I have spoken to my local MP, I've lobbied Parliament. And as you say, how many years now have we been hearing that it's going to be given a greater priority. Oh, yes, dementia will be given greater priority. And yet things don't seem to change. At least as far as I'm concerned, I don't feel that anything has been achieved or has changed. But to be able to get things to change, you know, even if they want to do it in small steps, then let's look at either pre-diagnosis, where there's a lot of research now, or just getting that dementia diagnosis early enough. There are a couple of drugs on the market, and I don't know how successful they are, but in order to get those to work, you have to get that diagnosis really quickly. You have to get it right at the very beginning, otherwise they don't work. And yet we're not in a position to do that. So it's almost like a chicken and egg situation for me. I don't know, unless government take it forward, we're never going to make those improvements. But it has to be all encompassing. The health and social care at the moment don't work because they ring fence different budgets and nobody wants to pay for anything out of their own budget and always want to pass it on to somebody else. It's never going to change until, well, I don't know. Is it in my view, Pete, the system is literally going to collapse. It's in crisis now. The whole of the system is in crisis. And me personally, I believe that there has to be a clear national strategy from government, not putting sticky plasters on things that, you know, aren't working very well. It needs a whole scale root and branch review and a whole scale change in how it's going to happen. Unless we've got that national strategy that's funded as well as the NHS is funded, then it's never going to happen. And what will continue to happen is that the system tends at the moment to, how can I put this, exploit carers rather than support them. And unless we get that, that's not going to change. And government rely on carers to bail them out financially. But at what cost? You know, at what cost to the carer and at what cost to the person who's has the dementia diagnosis? I do hate using the word carer, but I know it's the only one that people seem to understand. I always maintained that I was Joe's husband. I wasn't a carer, and it was my job to look after her. And again, that's what government rely on. They rely on people looking after their loved ones because they love them so dearly. Joe and I were together for over 50 years. There was no way I was going to turn my back on her when she needed me the most. So I think by lobbying Parliament and my MP, that's how I want to try and change the way government look at it. And I want them to hear my voice. I want them to hear my lived experience. I want them to hear how painful it was for not only for me, but for Joe as well. I want them to be able to hear the fact that I could cry for 45 minutes nonstop. I want them to hear the fact that, you know, when I had no help whatsoever, it would take me over half an hour just to get Joe into her pajamas at night time. And I would be taking one shoe off and she would be putting the other shoe back on again. I would go to get a hairbrush and she would be wandering down the stairs saying she wanted to go home. And it's I want them to hear that. I want them to hear the anger, I think, but the anger that's tempered to such a way that you don't lose the impetus and you maintain the moral high ground. But it does make me angry. It does make me very frustrated that really nobody wants to listen. So I'm sorry I've talked a bit about that question, but you can probably tell I'm very, very keen that people listen.
No, I think it's, you know, that is absolutely right. I mean, one thing comes out and, you know, some of these simple things really as well, isn't it? You know, you just say, yes, it is a big problem. It will require a lot of money, but there are really simple things that could be put in progress to make it a much better journey. But just one stat that came out, is it right that you phoned 42 care homes looking for respite care?
Well, it went up to 67 after that was published. 67 care homes. And not one would offer me a respite bed. They would offer me a bed if I was to phone up on the Monday of the week that I wanted the bed. And they had a spare bed for a few days, they would offer me that. However, that was of absolutely no good, no use to me whatsoever. I needed a break desperately, and I needed to get away from everything and everyone, really. I wanted to feel the sunshine on my back. And in order to do that, you have to book that weeks, if not months, in advance. And so for me to have a holiday, a break, meant that I needed to have a bed for Joe in 3 months' time, and nobody at all would offer me that. And it wasn't until I had another crisis moment when I was taking Joe to daycare that Bev Reid at the Bradbury Centre saw that I was in crisis and said she would pull out all of the stops to create a bed for Joe, which she did. It was the right thing to do. And you know, no doubt the Care Quality Commission wouldn't agree with that. But I think the CQC have a lot to answer for in terms of, I'm a great supporter of them making sure that they can't put time over quality, speed over accuracy. However, the word care in the Care Quality Commission doesn't seem to work very well with them. They have absolutely no compassion as far as I can see, because I was talking to them about trying to get Joe this bed and really they weren't interested. They said it would take them 12 weeks to be able to authorise a bed. And that was like, I really don't have 12 weeks, because in 12 weeks' time, I will be in hospital too. So not only will you have one person that you're having to pay for nationally, but there'll be two. Because if I go into hospital, Joe goes into care. Mm-hmm. And whilst I'm out of hospital, I'm not taking up a bed that could be used for other people. So for me, there seems to be a huge gap in the market. I understand that care homes are businesses. We've moved away from care being run by local councils or national. I remember the old days of home helps and when local government would run care homes. And so I understand that they're businesses and they have to make a profit, and they don't want to have an empty bed for one or two nights during the week because that's money to them. But there are ways around that. There are ways of saying that you wouldn't have an empty bed because you could have respite on periods of a week, or you know, break it down so that, you know, if somebody wanted 3 days, then they could have it if somebody was taking the other four, whatever the case may be. But I couldn't find anybody like that. And I was absolutely at my wit's end. Social services weren't any help when I asked them initially. All they did was say, oh, well, here's a list of care homes in the area. Not necessarily care homes who would take respite patients. Just here's a list. Now go away and start ringing around yourself. You know, I needed help at that stage. I couldn't deal with it. And I couldn't deal with the amount of rejection, asking the same question over and over again and getting the same answer over and over again. I needed somebody to help me do that. I needed social services to be able to say, this place has respite beds. They may or may not have them today, but they will take an advance booking. I needed somebody to help do that, and that just wasn't forthcoming. In the same way as getting a care package initially wasn't forthcoming. And I know they're under the cosh financially, but you know what, Pete? That's not my problem. You know? If I want or need something, then that's my requirement. I don't want to know that it's difficult for them because they don't have the finance or they don't have the staffing power to do it, because that's their problem. I have enough problems of my own to deal with without taking on theirs. So when I said, I need this, this, or this, and they come back to me about finance and staffing and all of those other issues that they have, I used to have to say to them, that's your problem. I've asked you to do something. Now you go away and work out how you can do that for me. I can't work it out for you because I don't know your systems and processes, and nor do I want your problems that you're trying to push back onto me. I need you to do something for me now. Go in and find out how to do it. But they don't want to do that. And I would have thought that was part of their job to do that. Why don't they want to do it? Why don't they want the help? Why do they offer the bare minimum?
I think, Bill, there are so many questions. Time is bringing us to a close. Thanks so much for sharing your experience. And I really hope that those MBs do sit and they do listen. And I'm sure they learn a lot. You went through a lot. Joe went through a lot. But, we're proud of people like you in the dementia community to have the courage to still go on and get the message out there, which is, it's what the D word's all about. And, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're very welcome. And if I can do anything for you in the future, Pete, please don't hesitate to ask me, because I will always say yes.
Many thanks to Bill for sharing his and Joe's story, and I wish him every success in his campaigning. I hope he continues to pose difficult questions that those in authority don't want to answer. Well, that's it for this time around. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me again soon here on the D Word Podcast.